Good evening. I'd like to call the meeting of the, May 3rd, Tompkins County Legislature to order. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members. Ms. Kiefer. Mr. Lane.
Here.
Ms. McAsee.
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne. Mr. McKenna.
Here.
Mr. Proto.
Here.
Ms. Pryor.
Here.
Mr. Robinson has asked to be excused. Mr. Shinagawa. Mr. Stein.
Here.
Mr. Burbank.
I'm here.
Ms. Chalk.
I am here.
Mr. Dennis.
Here.
Ms. Robertson.
Here.
And Ms. Kiefer, or Ms. Herrera has asked to be excused. We have 11 members present.
Thank you, Kathy. Is there something in the water today? I don't know. All right. I have a proclamation and for Team Immunization Awareness Month. And Karen, I believe you're here for this. Karen Bishop from the Tompkins County Health Department. Whereas vaccines are among the world's most successful and cost-effective public health tools available for preventing disease and death, and teenagers need immunizations to protect them against pertussis, tetanus, diphtheria, measles, mumps, rubella, meningitis, HPV, and varicella.
Varicella.
Thank you. Whereas immunizations are among the best ways parents can protect their children against serious diseases, and whereas national immunization levels are at or near record highs for most vaccines, and several vaccine-preventable diseases have been reduced by 99% or more since the introduction of vaccines, and whereas according to the United States Census Bureau 2008 population figures for Tompkins County, teenagers ages 10 years to 17 years total 7,303, representing 7.2% of the total county population estimate of 101,136. And whereas Teen Immunization Awareness Month focuses local attention on the importance of timely immunization for children ages 11 years through 18 years, and whereas the Immunization Coalition of Tompkins County has designated the month of May as Teen Immunization Awareness Month to emphasize the importance of immunizations for teenagers and to serve as a call to parents, healthcare providers, and other human service organizations to increase awareness of the importance of vaccinating teenagers prior to their 18th birthday. And whereas the month of May 2011 has been declared Teen Immunization Awareness Month to help ensure that Tompkins County teenagers have all their vaccinations by the age of 18. Now, therefore, I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim May 2010 as Teen Immunization Awareness Month and encourage businesses, government agencies, community-based organizations, and service groups to spread the immunization message throughout their communities. I also encourage public and private health care professionals, parents, and children's caregivers in Tompkins County to protect the health of children by ensuring early and on-time immunization against vaccine-preventable childhood diseases. Thank you, Karen, for bringing this to us.
I was here just a few weeks ago and for a different cause, immunization related, and I truly appreciate, on behalf of the Tompkins County Health Department, your support as our board in our endeavors to continue to immunize not only teenagers but the public at large as our community residents. So I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. We have no executive session for tonight. I'd like to invite the public to speak, and I have one signed up. And
I'm sorry, I forgot to sign off.
People can. Jim, did you have something?
No.
Okay. If anybody wants to speak after Tomo Shibata speaks, then that'd be fine. You just come up to the microphone. So, Tomo, the time limit is 3 minutes, and Kathy will help with the time limit.
I would like to correct the oral statement I made in this meeting at the end of last December concerning the veracity of the information County Forensics Specialist Sharon Conway provided regarding Cornell University Police Act barring me from the campus for one full year, which expired in July 2010. It is possible that the crime syndicate, which was hired to coordinate my organized stalking abuse, can approach the friends or family members of the detective who was investigating me to my case and implant him with biased information concerning, basically. So it is plausible that a fraction of the university police did have a racially and psychiatrically biased suspicion that I could commit a random shooting. Yet decided not to share this biased suspicion with the rest of the police. Therefore, I apologize for making a possibly erroneous statement concerning the veracity of the legal information Ms. Conway provided. I emailed a FOIA request to the CU police chief in order to ask to disclose any and all documents where my name is noted, and she forwarded the chief forwarded the request to the university attorney. And the attorney sent me a letter dating October 11th, 2010, stating the following. Cornell University is a private institution, and its police unit acts under the authority and supervision of Cornell's president, as set forth in New York Education Law, Section 5709. Cornell treats the record you are requesting as confidential, and I am not aware of any legal authority that requires production of such confidential records. Accordingly, the police will not provide the documents you requested. The secrecy and the lack of transparency of the university police assumed by this interpretation of the statute systematically prevents the alleged from contesting any report true or falsely fabricated concerning the alleged by the alleged for himself. Thus, this kind of statutory interpretation would deprive the alleged of the right to defense, and this is clearly unconstitutional.
1 minute, please. Okay.
The aforementioned interpretation of the statute invariably promotes the manipulation of the university police by organized stalking perpetrators. Those who are coordinating my organized stalking abuse must know the secret scheme established by this questionable statutory interpretation. The crime syndicate then purposely exploits this particular interpretation of the statute, which allows the secrecy of the university police record as a stratagem to thwart the contestation of organized perjury, which cunningly portrays the victim as a villain in the eyes of law enforcement as well as the whole community by manipulating the university police.
Time is up. Thank you very much. Hey, Gugakis.
Faye Gugakis, City of Ithaca. I'm here to talk to you about two bills that are on your desk that are before the Assembly and Senate, and they are on hydrofracking. And I didn't write this down, so I'm not going to do this quite well, so forgive me. I was in Albany yesterday for a rally, which also went down to the DEC and then to the governor's office, which many petitions were given to him for for a ban on hydrofracking. The people that spoke at the rally were very impressive. There was Senator Tony Avella and then William Colton, and I think he's from the Senate, if I could read this right. In any case, the important thing is that these bills are important and we need to encourage them to pass. Now, the first bill, I'm going to make it very simple because I don't have time to read it, is banning hydrofracking in New York State. The other one is categorizing the waste as hazardous waste. Now, I ask you to read this. Now, why is this important to us? Well, the reason I wanted a little extra time is because I was up on campus today, up at Cornell, part of a series of hydrofracking talks, and there was a representative of the Shell company. And one of the questions that I asked him is, do you know about the Clean Water Act, and do you think your company wouldn't mind being subjected to it? Because, you know, as you know, the Clean Water Act was taken out. Very, very important. And the man talks about all the different acts that were excluded. Now, he said, well, I don't know about the Clean Water Act. That alone was telling. There were a lot of things that were telling, but that was telling to me. The other thing that was telling is that these companies, because of our pressure, are improving their technologies. He talked about how they're starting to do the loop, you know, the where the waste goes round and round. But he also said they've only been doing it for a year and a half. That's not something he really talked about. It was during the Q&A. But what that was, not that I still want this to come to New York State, but that was very telling, because what we're doing in New York State is so important. There was another conference that was by the law students a couple weeks ago, and there was someone from the industry. He was the vice president of Mobil Oil, the vice president who came to speak, and he said not to do this, that Europe looks at us as it being barbaric. So these are the things that I pick up from the different events that I go to, and the education, self-education that I give myself, is that, you know, when it comes down to it, we are not ready to do this. Okay? There's some of us support a complete ban. But the ban is important. Why? Because it buys us time. Because everything that the companies have done is wreaked in deceivement. People that have signed leases weren't sure what they were getting into. Even the lawyers back then didn't know what they were getting into. So these bills are very important in protecting. It doesn't bring us back. It moves us forward. It moves us forward because it makes the companies accountable. And when you read the bills, you see they're not accountable to all the different acts that we worked so hard for all these decades to protect the American public. So it's not like you're anti-development or anti-fracking per se. You're protecting the world, even. You're protecting the world, and you're bringing forth technologies that will be good for us. And the ultimate thing is conservation, which was very low on the presenter's list today. So that's also very telling, because conservation under the Carter administration did work, and that's something we should be doing anyway. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Faye. Pam, I'd like to ask that the PDEC have a look at these bills, and you know, I know there are a bunch of other ones, so maybe you could have a look and see if there's something we should.
Right. Thank you, Faye. Thank you for agreeing.
Pass resolution, and thanks for going to Albany.
But chapter of the Sierra Club was there, and he was against the hydrofracking. So when you hear about the Sierra Club chapter in New York State is opposed and for the ban.
Thank you,
so,
Faye.
You're welcome.
Would anybody else like to address the legislature? All right. Are there any municipal officials out there? I don't necessarily recognize everybody, so. Okay. Legislators? Anyone? Pat?
Yes. Thank you, Martha. I would like to just mention that we had a very... Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I'd like to mention that we had a very successful meeting of the Broadband Committee on April 25th. We had two people from New York State here to talk to us about various aspects of broadband planning and deployment in the community, and it was very well attended. We have had a series now of meetings where we have had some people come in and speak, and we're going to be continuing that series this month, which I'll speak to in just a minute a little bit. One of the outcomes of this meeting on April 25th, which was reassuring to me, was that we asked about what would be your most important recommendations to Tompkins County to be ready to move forward with broadband planning or broadband implementation. And basically they said, do what you're doing. We're working on completing a gap map, which will show more precisely where the places are in the county that are either unserved or underserved. We're putting together information on various funding possibilities. We're planning a public information and awareness program, and they seem to feel that we're on the right track in what we're doing. So I thought that was very reassuring. We are going to be continuing our series this month, and I would like to especially acknowledge the work that Paula Younger has done to bring this series of speakers here to Tompkins County. She's worked very hard to put together our schedule and make those contacts, and it's been very, very helpful to the ongoing work of the committee. So thank you, Paula.
Thank you, Pat. Frank?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of, pardon me, on a little bit of a sober note, the none of us are immune to what transpired earlier this week in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, with regard to Osama bin Laden. But I want to tie that into a date that's coming up a little later this month. It generally gets confused, but Memorial Day is at the end of this month. Veterans Day is in November. Veterans Day is when we tend to celebrate people who are still alive as veterans, and Memorial Day is the one where we honor those that were killed in action or have passed. Please remember that there's a lot of people who, because of the incident that happened on September 11th a number of years ago, there were and there will be a lot of empty chairs and a lot of tables because of the deaths that took place there and the military that sacrificed over the last 5 years, a long time, in trying to bring this action to a close and a successful one. I think the president ought to be commended, and he ought to be complimented for his reaching out to both President Bush and President Clinton and incorporating them into his remarks. But I want to ask that on this particular Memorial Day, if we as a county legislature can try to attend, I know some of you attend these events, but if there's some way that we can all attend, or as many as possible attend, it would be, this particular one, I think, would be very well received. Some of us attend, we can only be in one place at a time, but we tend to go to the parade in Dryden, because Dryden puts on a wonderful parade for the for that day, and it would be great if you folks could find the time to turn out and spread the word on that one. Okay, enough of the somber one. This Saturday, I know Dooley and Jim are aware of this, there's an athletic event taking place, and it's not lacrosse. There's about 6 o'clock at night, there'll be maybe 20 or so horses lined up at Churchill Downs. And if any of you have a desire, several of us are going to be down at the boatyard, and I'll buy. But
you
if
buy
you'd
dinner?
Like, if you want cool. dinner, I'll buy you dinner, Martha. But all kidding aside, we're going to be down at the boatyard. If you want to come, you're certainly welcome to come. This will be a good one. Even though horses are dropping like flies and the track is a mess. But it would be a nice turnout. Go ahead, Pat, you were going to say something. Pat, you know, Dooley, Pat is one of us. Did you know that? She really is. Pat is among, this is one of Pat's hidden pleasures. She shared with me several months back her family's.
Is this executive session material?
This is public session, right? We can bare our breasts in this. That's hypothetical.
Frank.
I won't reveal,
it's only
Pat.
10:06. Where are we headed tonight?
Well, you're not going to have an executive session. We
go
might
ahead.
As well make up the time. Peter is keeping track of the time. You and I are running neck and neck, Martha. So
you're way out of here. Keep going.
I won't say another word, Pat. Thank you.
Anyone else? Dooley.
I believe I'm correct that Bill Downing passed away. He was a very creative and thoughtful person, an architect locally. I think he was 90. But for anyone who doesn't know anything about him, when we look at the DeWitt Mall, he had the foresight to purchase that. Old was the original Ithaca High School, then it was used as a junior high school. He purchased it and turned it into downtown mixed use, apartments and stores. and it still is one of the prime tourist spots in the county. So I wanted to acknowledge what he's done for the community. I miss him.
Thank you, Dooley.
Bill Downing was the architect on our mental health building.
Leslin?
I don't know the date. I know it was announced in the paper today.
Okay. Leslin?
Just a couple of quick things. For those of you and us in the Ithaca City School District, tomorrow evening at GIAC from 5:30 to 7:30 is a Meet the Candidates Forum. It's school board elections coming up, I think the 13th. I have my date. I could have it wrong. No, it's not the 13th. It's the 18th. Anyhow, and tomorrow evening is a Meet the Candidates Forum, so you're all encouraged to come and see what caliber of candidates we have running to fill the seats in our school board. We're gearing up for the Ithaca Festival. I don't see any buttons just yet, but we'll have her soon. And on Saturday, the Ithaca Festival has been doing some really early kickoff events. They had a paint-off, and on Saturday, it's a kids' day. Again, it's occurring at GIAC from 1 to 4. It's fun, fun, fun at the Ithaca Festival. And I also want to just mention briefly that last night I had the opportunity to attend a screening of the documentary on the Freedom Riders. Words cannot describe just the emotions that it brought up. But one of the important questions that came up in the talk back was just about, would you get on the bus? If you see what these folks have gone through, you see what they were doing, would you get on the bus? And I had to think long and hard about that and think about the things that we're doing as a legislature, getting on the bus around hydrofracking and just realizing that so much of it comes down to just basic human rights, human dignity, human equality. So whether we get on the bus for integration, whether we get on the bus regarding issues of discrimination, we get on the bus regarding issues of hydrofracking, or we get on the bus around tax caps, it's all about just basic human needs and equality and coming to that realization. So I want to leave you with that question to think about. If we had situations like were happening in the Freedom Riders took their lives in their hands and went down to Alabama, would you get on the bus? Let's just think about it. There's just so much going on and continuing to happening in our community. So I wanted to share that. I know there's another, because it was sold out last night, I know there's another screening on the 9th, Monday the 9th. I don't know the details of how you get a ticket, so please don't ask me. Michelle Berry would be the person to contact. And it will be at GIAC because we were sold out last night. But it was quite an eye-opener and just a reminder of how important it is to continue to do the work that we do in protecting people's human rights. So thanks for letting me share that.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Carol.
Yes, I'll add my thanks, too. And I think this is a real week of celebrating what we can accomplish. As the president pointed out, this week, when Americans put our minds to accomplishing something, we really can set out and accomplish it. And I will just add my hopes that as we move forward as a nation, that we will set our minds to accomplishing equality, equity, and energy policy that makes sense for the future, because I think it's possible. We just need the will to do so. Speaking of getting on the bus, I wanted to ask Pat a question about the broadband committee and direction. As Pat, I really feel like you've gotten on the bus on broadband. The committee, it's a huge subject with an awful lot of information, and that's hard to cut through. And I think you and the committee are just doing a great job of figuring out how to approach it. And I had occasion to attend the session you're talking about. I was a little discouraged to hear from our state representatives it's not representatives, they were the state staff people in charge of addressing broadband, and I understand that a lot of their task is to figure out how to make use of, the effective use of the TARP money, but I found their analysis, their data and their analysis of the level of need in our county to be way off the mark. And I think the audience felt that as well. And their data show that Tompkins County is 97% covered with broadband availability. That didn't make any sense to me. I understand there's aspects of the methodology. It's can you pay at any price and get a satellite link and have broadband come to your home, but that's not really doable for most of our residents. So I hope as the committee move forward, I'd just like to put in a plug to have you figure out how to address that question, let them know in more detail than we could at that meeting where their data missed the mark, and figure out how to communicate that so they, in a way, they might be able to hear it this time. Thanks.
Point's very well taken, Carol. I don't know, Martha, if you want me to speak to it at all now or not.
Sure, go ahead, and then Mike.
Okay. What Carol is talking about is the, I think, primarily, is the map that the state has recently been working on, which for the first time attempts to identify on a statewide basis where broadband coverage and high-speed access is available and where it is not. And by the nature of the task, they have used certain criteria, which especially in, I think, in rural counties, counties with a lot of rural area, probably is producing a fair amount of inaccuracy. And I think Carol's entirely correct that it's not correct to say that we have 97% or 97 point something percent coverage in Tompkins County. What they explained is that they used a method of relying on census blocks. They had to pick something, and so that's what they picked. And in any case where they found that even one person in a particular census block has access to high speed, they made the assumption for the purpose of their mapping project that everybody in that same census block has access. And we all know that particularly in rural areas, that's not the case. So I would say that although the state has made a step toward trying to identify those areas, that they still have a great deal of work to do to bring those maps to the level of accuracy that we would need for our purposes in planning. Fortunately, we have a very committed subcommittee of people who are working specifically on getting that information for Tompkins County. So we're going to regard the information we get from the state as a first step and as part of the input that we will need. I think we can assume that if they say that there's coverage in a particular census block, that there is some place in that census block, but then we're going to have to go out and more carefully identify exactly where those places are covered and where they are not. One of the things that I'm very pleased to see is that we've had cooperation and are having cooperation from our local providers. Our local providers are really stepping up to the plate and helping us with this effort. So, yes, we're very aware of that, Carol. And when I mentioned before during my very brief comments that we're working on a gap map, that's exactly what we're talking about, a map that would be much more precise in identifying the places where there are gaps in coverage. And that's certainly one of the goals, one of our primary goals.
Thank you, Pat. Mike?
A couple of things. One, thanks to Frank and Leslin for really heartfelt comments tonight. I appreciated those. Tomorrow night, the Civil War Commission meets at 7:15 at the Old Jail. Glad to have visitors to that meeting. Glad to have our representatives at that meeting as well. What I wanted to say a couple words about tonight was the disasters we've been seeing around the country, the number of losses of life from particularly the tornadoes in the south, but we're not exempt from tornadoes here. Fortunately, most of the ones we've had in the last few decades have not been of the magnitude of those they see in other areas, but they still do damage. And certainly the folks in Danby, up on Hilltop Road in that area that lost garages and roofs and other things, know the effect of wind. It was in the middle 1990s that one of those tornadoes came down my street in the village of Dryden, and I watched out the window as trees were uprooted and a barn across the street was pushed over, and the part of the town barn was injured at the same time. I want to really thank the efforts of our emergency services department and our public information department for getting out the word about these storms, about the potential for flooding, about what people should do in the event of flooding and what they shouldn't do, and high winds. And people need to stay alert in these kinds of when these kinds of things happen, because people can get hurt here. We've been very, very lucky, and I think a lot of that is due to the education activities that are done out there by our county people. So stay alert, stay tuned, and we'll all stay alive.
Thank you very much, Mike. I did talk to the supervisor of the town of Danby, Rick Diedrich, and ask whether there was anything people could do in general or that we could do specifically, and he said the community is really stepping up, and people, neighbors are helping each other. So I really thank you for your comments. And yeah, I think we really, I like to say to my sister in California, where they have earthquakes and mudslides, it's really safe here. The snow comes down slowly, you know, you see it coming. But sometimes there are these things that you don't see coming. So this is a big one. Thank you. Carol?
Just a quick note to the clerk of the legislature. As you were taking attendance, as you came to Nathan Shinagawa, I just want to make sure that he gets registered as excused. I think that he's provided information to all of us that he is at the White House today, invited on behalf of, or as a county official. I think that's very exciting. Tompkins County is on the map for those kinds of meetings, that one of our members would be invited. And he kindly asked us for input to bring to that meeting, too. So I'm looking forward to hearing about the meeting when he comes back.
Thanks, Carol. Anyone else? All right. We are privileged tonight to have Michael Sam and Heather Filiberto from TCAD, Tompkins County Area Development. I'd love to have you come and make a presentation to us on your work. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm hoping Frank won't bare his breast while I'm speaking. Quite a distraction.
We're all hoping that, Michael.
There was some talk of it earlier.
Is that a challenge?
No, not by any means. I'm going to speak for a very brief moment in time, and Heather's really the one that's going to make this presentation about our revolving loan fund program, but I'd like to start with a very brief overview of TCAD. We're a private, not-for-profit development corporation. We're not part of the county government, but we work very closely with you folks and your staff. Our mission, very generally, is to create quality jobs for local residents. We have a pretty big board of directors, almost 30 people. A couple of you folks sit on our board, and it's very diverse, again, includes labor, representative from tourism, public and private sector leaders. Have a staff of five. Sources of revenue are fairly diverse as well. We have membership income from local employers, fee-based income, as well as government income. One of the things that we do is focus on companies that sell products or services to customers outside the county. And this is basically a pie chart that describes our local economy. On the left side, which says other, is the local churn. On the right side are products and service sectors that sell and bring money in. And you can see that we're dominated by educational services, manufacturing and high-tech services, very, very broadly defined, is quite large, and that's probably the one sector that we spend most of our time on, although we do provide tax-exempt bonding to Cornell and Ithaca College. Programs and initiatives over the year, we manage the Industrial Development Agency, we manage the relatively new Development Corp. Heather's going to talk about the loan funds. Heather is still working on the Empire Zone program. Even though it's defunct, we still have to manage that program and a list of other things. So we launched the CUGA Venture Fund, which is now, I think, getting ready to close on its fourth fund, very, very successful. We started the Air Service Task Force, which is morphed into the Air Service Board. So I think you can see that in addition to delivering direct services to local employers, we've also done a lot to the ecosystem and infrastructure that supports economic development. This is the segue to Heather. And again, we spend a lot of time working with entrepreneurs, some a little bit brighter than others, and in delivering low interest, very high risk funds to them, and we've been very successful doing that over the time. So I'll hand it over to Heather.
Thanks, Michael. So when Michael gave me his slides, and he had the slide with the pie chart about maximizing scarce resources, it was by sector, and the actual pie chart didn't come through in the email, so it just said maximizing scarce resources. And of course, I thought he meant doling out our loan funds. So this was the slide that I came up with. But in many respects, maximizing scarce resources is something that we have to think about all the time, whether it's what sector we're dealing with or what kind of program funds we have available to work with, or even maximizing staff time. I pushed the wrong button. Okay. There we go. So TCAD's revolving loan fund, in terms of maximizing resources, we have a couple of objectives that we like to fulfill. We focus on projects that create quality employment opportunities and strengthen the tax base. We pretty much target our loan fund to businesses selling a product or service to customers outside of Tompkins County. If you go back to that pie chart that Michael showed, it's that export sector. And in limited circumstances, we do provide loans to businesses that are selling a product or service to a specific geographic market where it's not readily available. My big example of that is a supermarket in Danby. I've been in Tompkins County for 10 years, and it's still an applicable example. We don't have a supermarket out in Danby, so we're still waiting to fund one. In terms of the history of our loan fund, we actually manage four loan funds within our umbrella of the TCAD Revolving Loan Fund. The TCAD fund was started in 1987. It was capitalized with some money from one of our state elected officials. We did such a good job with it in 1990, they gave us a little bit more money. Our Minority and Women Loan Fund, we started in 1992, and that was capitalized by a very competitive grant from Empire State Development, which is New York State's economic development entity. In 2008, I think the county really stepped up and recognized the ability of TCAD to manage our loan fund in a responsible manner, and you granted us funds that the county planning department had managed for several years that were former federal HUD funds to the tune of $500,000, and then shortly thereafter the town of Dryden followed suit with $100,000. So over the past couple of decades, we've received a little over $800,000 to make loans in the community that support economic development. Our loan funds are generally used for real estate acquisition, construction and renovation, purchase of fixed assets, equipment, sometimes permanent working capital, and in very limited circumstances, we have gone in and refinanced some existing debt only if it really was a required element to make a project work. And generally, our funds are a complement to traditional bank financing. A lot of times, a bank will not be willing to take on the risk of the loan on an entire project, and they'll contact us or some of our regional partners and say, you know, are you willing to come in and help us a little bit for a company that might be fairly new, a year or two old, and they're just not sure if they're willing to take the risk. So that's where we really come in and we talk about providing gap financing. Our revolving loan fund is provided with a lot of expertise and assistance from our loan committee, which is a subcommittee of TCAD's board. Both board members and non-board members sit on it from different sectors, someone who's an entrepreneur, someone who owns a small business, an accountant, a banker, someone from the Cuga Venture Fund, that, you know, really provide an overall vision for our loan fund. They provide oversight. They provide a tremendous amount of guidance, not only to me, but to our loan applicants. We've had situations with loan applicants that they're just not ready to take on debt, and our loan committee has provided pro bono time, hours of time to meet with them and help them go over their financials or find other resources. So our loan committee really, if I had a Superman and a Superwoman sticker, that would be right up there with our loan committee. Since we started our loan program in the early 1980s, we've done 52 loans totaling about $1.8 million. And just to give you a sense of how busy we've been over the past 2 years, we've done 9 loans, and a lot of that was made possible by the county's granting us of that $500,000 fund, which I succeeded in loaning out in about a year. So there's definitely a lot of need in the community. Of those 52 loans, those projects, they projected creating 432 jobs. The last reports we have, they've created over 841 jobs. And our default rate, we looked at it sort of two ways last year, was 11% of all the loan amount loaned, which is much lower than the default rate of the Small Business Administration's loan program, their loan guarantee program. And they say they do pretty risky loans. We do even riskier loans a lot of times than the federal government will. We fill the gap where the banks won't, where the SBA won't. So 11% of our loans, or 3% of the total dollar amount loaned, has defaulted. And just to give you a couple of examples of some recent loans that we've done, Sunbeam Candles is a green candle manufacturer that moved from outside of the county into Tompkins County. They're located up on Mecklenburg Road. They relocated their solar panels, so they're generating their own power for their facility, and they make all-natural candles using beeswax and dye-free, chemical-free wicks. They plan to almost double their size in the next couple of years. Comet Action Sports is a company that relocated here from Oakland, California, to be close to their source materials. They make skateboards for the skateboard industry. And right after we did our loan to them last year, they had just moved their, they have a manufacturing facility that's up in the town of Enfield, and their retail facility, they had just moved and were getting ready to open up a retail storefront on the commons. There was a fire down on the commons. They quickly sort of reshuffled and went a new direction, and they're getting ready to move back onto the commons in another month or so. But we were able to come in and assist them with a little bit of additional capital on a second loan to help them get their feet back on the ground again. Cortland Produce recently moved into the old Ithaca Produce building. relocated their fourth-generation family operation from Cortland after an exhaustive search of the Cortland area. And they are already growing. I think they've hired four people since they opened their business operation just a month ago here in Tompkins County. Primet Precision Materials is sort of the newer type of company that we're providing loans to, a little bit riskier loans. Primet is an early stage development company. They're still doing research and development. They don't actually have a product that they're selling. They're doing research and development around materials to make advanced batteries. And what we did was we provided a loan for some fixed assets to scale up their research and development and their production facility in the town of Ithaca. Our loan fund traditionally provided loans to manufacturers. And our loan committee sat down a couple of years ago and took a very hard look at the kinds of businesses that were sort of falling through the cracks in the traditional banking arena. And what we found was that there's a lot of high-tech companies, startup companies that are spinning out of Cornell Technology, that there's just this sort of gap before they really get their production going and they're able to get a bank loan. So we made a conscious decision to make riskier loans to earlier stage businesses like Primet. They've got over 25 employees in the town of Ithaca, very high-paying jobs, and we've done a couple of these loans over the past year, a little bit larger loans than we've traditionally done. We used to do loans around $30,000 or $50,000. We're doing $75,000, $100,000. I think we even did one at $125,000. So it's sort of a new decade for us. We are jumping on the bus, I guess. And so far it's been very successful. And I can just say as an anecdote that it's these high-tech startup companies that pay their loan payments on time every month, and I never have to call them and say, where's my loan payment? So far it's been a really good sort of new thing for us. And in a nutshell, that's our loan fund at TCAD. And I did leave invitations to our annual meeting on everyone's table. If you're around next Tuesday morning at 8 a.m., we'd love to have you. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Heather and Michael. Peter, and then Frank, and Carol.
That was very interesting, Heather. I have two questions. One is a short one. The other one maybe is longer. The short one is Cortland Produce. Is that an agricultural activity that you're loaning to grow?
Cortland Produce is a warehouse and distribution company. They carry over 4,000 products, most of their products being produce. Their niche market is that they deliver to mostly local restaurants and universities.
Okay. And the second was on that mysterious pie chart that first got shown. And I hate it when I have a pie chart where 50% of it says other. I'm much happier when 5% says other. And I don't really know what's in other? What's the biggest classification?
Well, again, this is a pie chart that represents the value of all the goods and services produced in Tompkins County. That's about $4.3 billion. We focus on the companies that sell their product or services to customers outside the county. That's on the right side. The left side is companies selling to local residents. So that's retail,
okay. All right.
Commercial.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Frank. Frank?
Thanks, Martha. Heather, wasn't Primet the manufacturing outfit that Congressman Hinchey just was able to bring some funds into the county for?
Yes, he did make an announcement that made the front page of the Ithaca Journal. Last week on Thursday, we were up at Ithaca College, and they announced that he was able to help them to secure some funding from the U.S. Department of the Army to do some research for them.
The other comment is, I hope the bus you're jumping on is TCAT.
A solar-powered TCAT bus?
PRIMET's an interesting story in that two entrepreneurs were traveling around the Northeast looking for a place to locate their business. They were coming from the Maryland area. They had about five stops on their list. We were the first one, and we lined them up with venture capitalists, people that knew about the workforce, people that could talk about vacant space in the community, and they never went any further.
Carol, Mike, and then Jim.
Thanks to both of you. I think that you do a really good job of leading your loan committee through a process to figure out exactly where to target. And those are primarily public funds that have gone in over the years. I wonder if to target the areas that are, you know, opportunity that is holes that are opportunities not covered other places. And I realize that some of them are risky. I wonder if there's been any discussion, or could be, without responding, you don't necessarily have to respond here, but I hope you'll take back the notion to the committee of thinking about ways to recapture for those businesses that we help at a really early stage that take off. And I assume there will be some, I hope there will be some over the years that do, ways to make sure that we recapture in some kind of way a payback that recognizes or a long-term, very far in the future equity position, some way that recognizes that we took a risk at an early stage in their development and they either give back to the loan fund in some way, more, you know, commensurate with their success is the word I'm looking for, yes, or a commitment to contribute in a similar way to the businesses of the future. There are lots of ways to think about doing that.
We do that now, and we're one of the only revolving loan fund programs in the nation that does this. So with some of the high-tech companies where there's likely to be, if they're successful, a pretty big liquidity event, we have warrants with those companies, which are essentially stock options. So we do have the opportunity to take an equity position in these companies at a specific point in time for a specific value for shares of stock. And it's very, very innovative, and that's why we have representatives from the local venture fund community on our loan fund to help us negotiate those kinds of quasi-debt, quasi-equity deals.
That's great. And then I have another question. Is just, are you seeing other businesses come forward with interest that relate to sustainability and sort of the whole green business cycle?
We are, and one of our goals at TCAD over the next year or so is really to define sustainability for us and how that translates to the work that we do. Our loan committee has seen this sort of wave of green and sustainable businesses. We've actually identified a funding source, applied for some grant funds to add an additional fund specifically for sustainable businesses. So I actually have a meeting with that grant fund next Friday, so we're crossing our fingers.
Michael, I was going to talk a little bit about the I-6 grant process in my report, but why don't you talk about that? Because I think that's in relation to Carol's question. I think that's an important step.
The federal government has a source of grant funds that they're making available to regions that do already have tech transfer happening but need to fill some gaps. And in conjunction with the leadership at Cornell University, NYSERDA, some venture capitalists, and TCAD, we've submitted a letter of intent and hopefully we'll submit a full application for grant funds that will help develop a better ecosystem to accelerate the development of green businesses. And certainly there's a lot of folks at Cornell in the state that are interested in this, and Cornell has included TCAD as a partner in their application.
And as part of that process in the last couple of weeks, the deadline was yesterday, Michael and I, along with Joe and Ed Marks, met a couple times with CTEC, once with CTEC, and with a number of scientists and researchers from Cornell, plus Ken Schlaughter, Cooperative Extension, and a couple of folks from the community working on biomass in Danby, for example. It generated a great deal of excitement with people realizing that, you know, there's all this stuff happening here and this stuff happening here, but got to get them together. And so it looks like we've already got one meeting being set up to follow that whole effort, so that even if we don't get that grant, or if we do get the grant, we will have sort of taken some more steps in the meantime to really develop the environment that will make these kinds of things, you know, happen in the real world. So not just up in the labs, but to really bring them home. So, Mike and then Jim.
Thanks for the report, folks. Mike, I wondered what TCAD is doing now about creating new space for manufacturing near the airport. For example, the Warren Road Industrial Park concept, so that we can be ready to move businesses there when they need to expand, and we don't see them lost to Cortland, like Cuga Press, like the Borg Warner plant that went up there a few years ago. Cortland is very active in creating space of that sort, and if we don't have any, that's where the jobs will be. And I wondered what we're doing about it. We've talked about it for too many years.
We worked with some interested folks in the town of Lansing for about 3 years and have just succeeded in getting a sewer line up Warren Road beyond the airport up to a little business park up there, which has been a phenomenal location for businesses that have rented small spaces and grown to the point where they need to build their own building. So there's now a sewer line up there to facilitate near-term business expansion. There are a couple of empty lots that are sewered and what we call shovel-ready. There are also lots along Warren Road that are owned by Cornell and others that are owned by the county that now are in that sewer district. And it's land that if someone were growing to the point where they wanted to build a building, it's a perfect location for light industrial manufacturing type business. We've had a lot of meetings with the town of Dryden and the village of Dryden in terms of some land that was annexed into the village, was formerly located in an Empire Zone, to try and facilitate some future development there. And so that's sort of where we've been headed over the past couple of years. We have land that's ready to go if someone comes to us ready to build.
So are we out there looking? I see some high-tech, nanotech plants are going into the Hudson Valley with strong New York State support. We're close to Rochester, obviously, and Cornell in those kind of technologies. Are we getting any feelers about building anything here?
We're working with Cornell University in a highly targeted business attraction program. So we've identified the research and development activities that are world-class at Cornell, that are commercializable, and then identifying Cornell alum that are in C-level positions in companies, and there's many of those. So the decision-makers that are often trying to determine where they're going to locate often have ties to Cornell. So we're talking to the heads of companies that are making those site location decisions, and it's a long haul, but there are prospects out there. For example, one of the probably the most powerful industrialists in India is a Cornell trustee and Cornell alum, and he and his company are establishing sites all over North America. So those are the kinds of strategies that we're using for business attraction.
Thank you.
Jim, and I have a question.
Thank you, Martha. I just want to say that I've known about this organization for many years, and And I think they've been able to weather not only the bad times, but have done well in the good times because they've been strong, they've had good leadership, and they've been able to deal in the community at times when things were very tough economically. And I think they should be, you know, feel pretty happy about what they've been able to do in Tompkins County, given the fact we have 40% of the property off the tax roll. They're constantly trying to do things and bring jobs to this community, and I think they've been very successful at that.
Thank you, Jim. My question is about, you know, it's interesting. The IDA gets the headlines, right? We do the stuff where you got darts to throw at us. So the loan fund is another piece of it, but both of those are just part of a whole spectrum of services you provide to entrepreneurs. If you could just kind of flesh that out just a little bit so people have a better idea of the whole spectrum of what you do.
Yeah, we listed some programs and initiatives on one slide, but you know we work with people that are already employed that want to start a new business. Encodema is a great example of that. The CEO that launched that was employed, wanted to start his own business. We loaned him the money for his first piece of equipment, and now he has, 50-some employees, where Coal Our Machine used to be. All the way to the other end of the spectrum, working with BorgWarner and recently delivering state funds to them for training and new equipment, and they're actually back to the pre-recession levels, which is a great thing. We issue, through the IDA, tax-exempt debt to help local not-for-profits, from small not-for-profits like Ithaca Community Child Care all the way up to financing Lake Source Cooling at Cornell University. As we mentioned earlier, we helped launch the CUGA Venture Fund, which has been extremely successful, the Finger Lakes Entrepreneurs Forum. We launched, spun off, and recently took back and are managing that. We did the comprehensive sewer water study for the county, which is key to future business development. We're working with a really large prospect right now for the community, and they need to be in a really specific kind of location, and it's kind of hard to find that location that has sewer in our community. So that's one of the reasons why we did the sewer and water analysis. So I think that's just an example of the array of things we do, delivering services directly to businesses, but also broad-ranging programs that are the ecosystem that's important for business development. One last thing, we created the Workforce Investment Board before the federal government created the legislation that required it. So we were a step ahead of them, and we're the first operating Workforce Investment Board in New York State.
All right. Quickly?
I share the sentiments around the table that the incredible job that you do. When the topic of economic development comes up in the legislature or in the PDEC committee, and we try to push our planning department to take on some economic development project, the response is usually, well, we have TCAD do that for the legislature, and that you're sort of our arm that we think of as delivering when we have the programs or the CDBG funds or things, money we want to put in. And I've struggled with that answer sometimes in terms of how do we establish a process whereby we give you more input or where you solicit input from us, and without there being, I mean, you have your own board of directors, and without there being any
annoying micromanaging.
You know, without you being held to our responses, without you having to deliver on all the responses we give you, it would be interesting develop some kind of process whereby you come to us, whether it's in writing or questionnaire or a session once a year that says what are our priorities in economic development for the future? Where would we want to see if we could dream big?
And how do we work together to make sure we raise money, we allot money, and back you up as you apply for money from outside sources, as well as allot our CDBG and other funds?
I guess a couple things. There are two of your colleagues sit on TCAD's board of directors, so we would rely on them to bring to us or engage in a discussion about the county's interest in economic development, and we report to PDEC, and we would expect that PDEC would be the committee that represents you folks and would tell us what we ought to be doing, what we ought to be doing better, or what we should stop doing.
And four of us, you know, historically and unfortunately, according to some people, are on the IDA board, so
right.
So we know you pretty well. So.
I just wanted to add that before this meeting began, I actually had a conversation with Mike about TCAD coming to PDEC, the planning committee meeting, and having sort of a different kind of discussion than just a report, but having a discussion about economic development in the county and, you know, and perhaps coming up with some sort of specific things that we can focus on in our discussions as a way to perhaps change, enrich the discussion that we are having on economic development.
And we would welcome that and certainly think you're getting your $8,000, $200 worth. So.
But who's counting, Mike?
I wasn't going to say that.
That's enough.
In fact, the city contributes more than we do at this point. Anything else from Michael and Heather? All right. Thank you both very much.
I think we used up our 10 minutes.
I think so. Thank you. Well, it's really important, and we appreciate you
thank
being
you.
Here. Thanks very much. As for my report, let's see. I was going to talk about the tornado. I was going to talk about Nathan at the White House. And I was going to talk about the grant, this green grant. I'm really excited about some relationships that maybe have gotten started and some that have been strengthened to get people moving in the direction of how can we decrease our carbon footprint and increase green jobs and economic development in that direction. I wanted to mention that the Tompkins County Council of Governments, which seems every meeting is really packed full. We did talk, among other things, about the we talk about hydrofracking every meeting. And Don Barber has written a letter to the DEC asking that the comment period on the next version of the SGEIS be extended to 90 days with 6 to 10 regional public comment hearings as well. So I wanted to report that that was requested and done. I had a conversation. We were supposed to meet with Kevin McCabe actually this afternoon, and he's Governor Cuomo's regional representative, and that had to be rescheduled, and I think we're still in the works of confirming that. I did have a long conversation with him yesterday, about 45 minutes in lieu of that meeting, and obviously the meeting we have will be a follow-up. I copied y'all on one of the issues that I raised with him, and that was about research that was documenting the actual impact rather than the imputed impact of higher taxes on what do the wealthy do if you raise their taxes. This was an NPR story on April 29th. So that was just one of the topics I spoke to him about since we had passed that resolution unanimously calling on the governor and the state to support keeping the taxes on the higher taxes on people with $1 million of income or more. The other issues I talked about with Kevin on the phone were especially the tax cap, the lack of mandate relief, the home rule measures that we're still waiting for action about, and I told him, you know, that when Andrew Cuomo was here as a candidate in August, I and many of others of us were there and spoke to him afterwards. And I said, you know, I raised this. Everybody else wanted to talk about fracking. I wanted to talk about the tax cap because that was his signature issue then. And I said, you really, you know, you can't do this without dealing with the mandates. And all you're doing is talking about the tax cap, and we don't hear anything about mandates. It's all about blame the counties, and they're going to impose fiscal discipline. So they're back in Albany. They're back from their vacation. I do say vacation. We didn't see any of our senators in public during the 2 weeks that they were off, even though we tried to get them to any public meetings. The governor had a press conference yesterday and was determined and, you know, sort of berating the legislature that they disrespected New Yorkers if they don't pass a tax cap. My message is, Governor Cuomo, you disrespect counties if you don't pass mandate relief. And I cannot say that strongly enough, and that's pretty much how I said it to Kevin McCabe. I will follow up with another message to him. They are real serious about, and as I've heard a couple of senators on the radio this week, they want to pass a clean tax cap. They don't want it watered down, you know, with any exemptions like we've been trying to get. So, you know, Joe will talk about this later, but we will be scheduling meetings, public meetings around the county about our budget before we get into the weeds of it, but we'll be having some meetings to help people understand the situation we're in. And I expect that a lot of that time will be on what are these mandates and what's the alternative here? Why are we, why do we complain about this? Because New York has imposed these programs on us, cut their taxes, the income taxes on people, and pushed the cost to us. And now we are seeing ramping up of the rhetoric blaming counties that lack fiscal discipline. So you'll hear more about this, you know, from me as I copy you on those messages. I encourage you to sort of send your own messages off as well. So stay tuned. Did you want to say something? Frank?
When you're done.
When I'm done. That's all about that. I do want to mention the... this is also season for local candidates for local elections to get interested and get involved. And we're going to have a lively mayor's race, that's clear. But I know that there are a lot of races that are, I've been talking to some people about races in some of the outlying towns. This is the time for people to get on the bus about, you know, whatever your issue is, somebody has to be on these boards, and I hope people can be encouraged to step up. And run for local office. It doesn't hurt. And just finally, one appointment, chair's appointment to the Workforce Investment Board, Joe Mariana, because he doesn't have enough meetings to go to. Jim, Frank, and then Jim.
Thank you.
Martha, you mentioned in your report that we'll have a series of meetings regarding the budget as we roll this out for the public. Can I make a suggestion? In the old days, which may have only been last year, we used to pull together the committee chairs. Could I suggest that perhaps you do that so that those of us that are chairing certain committees can weigh in on any presentations or whatever? At least we'll be up to speed on before we go out to the public for items and on that particular item. I mean, not that any of us need another meeting, but...
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good opportunity. I mean, Joe, I think Joe thinks in PowerPoint, and that certainly helps organize the information. So that's a good idea to sort of run through
Thanks. What
might be covered in that kind of a meeting. And the idea here is just to sort of coordinate schedules so that, you know, all the regions of the county are covered, and each legislator can sort of be sure that they're kind of representing their constituency at least one of those meetings, and that we don't run our staff wild, you know, crazy. Jim?
I have some breaking news. I was perusing my electronic device against the rules, and Nathan just shook the president's hand and met Joe Biden.
That's great.
I don't know if there's anything cooler than that.
Well, I wonder whether he's... I'm sure there's going to be a picture on Facebook coming up.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Already is?
There already
you have
is.
It? Well, if you can ramp that up, Kevin, that's great. That's great.
Oh, man.
All right, that's it for my report. County Administrator Joe Mariano.
Thanks, Martha. I have a few things at the end. We're going to do a little bit of audio-visual, and I hope to be economical in my use of your time. Some catch-up items. I did want to report that Julia Maddock and I had a meeting last week with Congressman Hanna in Utica with three other workforce investment organizations to try to impress upon the congressman how important continued funding for these programs is in spite of the bad times that we're in. I found him very receptive, challenging. I think his style tends to be to challenge, to understand the depth of your arguments and the strength of your arguments, and I think we gave him several good ones. So believe it or not, workforce investment money is on the table in terms of a potential cut to balance the federal budget. So, again, I think we did a pretty good job in explaining this is a program that's important not only in bad times when people really need help trying to find new employment opportunities. It's also important in good times in an economy that changes very rapidly and helping people adjust to a rapidly changing economy and quickly get trained for a new position. So I think we had a really good 90-minute meeting with the congressman last Friday. This may be stepping on a topic Frank will bring up. The CHA, you recall that we've been trying to schedule a panel discussion about the qualitative side of our certified home health agency. We had tentatively scheduled it for May 5th. We had two of our four panelists who had abrupt conflicts in their schedule. And rather than to just scrub this, because we think a lot of good information is going to come out as a result of a discussion like this, we're scrambling to reschedule. It looks like that the rescheduled date that would work for the panelists would be May 10th at 4:30 in the afternoon at the Health Department on Brown Road. And I apologize for the jostling of schedules. This isn't what we wanted. We're trying to bring together a lot of expertise to one place and one time. We're trying to accommodate their schedule, so hopefully you'll be able to attend that. I think it will be an important event that, again, we'll talk about the qualitative side, not just the numbers of the CHA.
Excuse me, Joe.
Time again?
Yes, May 10th at 4:30 p.m. at Brown Road.
This is something different than you passed out by email recently?
It could be. Again, the event was originally, the target was May 5th, same time. It's now May 10th.
Joe, yeah. I saw emails just before I turned off my computer.
I have it on May 10th.
Excuse.
Yeah.
That this is the same time as the city's Board of Assessment Review or something like
it's
that?
It's the Tompkins County Assessment Department, holds their meetings and it's
their grievance.
But for the city area, so all five of the representatives who would represent city districts could potentially, are invited.
Is that the
only
six?
One on that? Who has that date down?
Yeah, that's 3 to 6, right?
That's
Joe, what time is the meeting?
4:30 to 6. The problem was that same week, I think there are two committee meetings that run from 3:30 until 5:30 or so.
And Dryden has its assessment thing on Friday. Do you think there's any... I mean, and I know we're also up against a time problem because we want to have information ready for the committee and then for the legislature. There's a real careful timeline to try... Here's a question. Can this be taped?
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. Is this as we were talking... I don't know why not.
Could you do it here?
Well, we're encouraging people to attend. Right. So we probably need a bigger room than this. The Brown Road, the large conference room, is really a good venue for it. But I don't know why we couldn't tape it.
The equipment,
right.
Yeah, and it may not be the same production quality as this. It may be more of a...
Awesome.
Right. Well,
if
we can ask you to, or maybe the Livesey room, and isn't there equipment there? Or there seems to be that's done. All right, we'll work on this.
Around. We'll do what we can. And again, I know how difficult schedules are. The same problem was true with the panelists, who we really would like to bring to the table, so that you can get the benefit of their thoughts. So.
Right.
We'll do the best to accommodate with location and with technology.
Peter?
Yeah, about that report, I found it quite opaque. I had a hard time understanding many of the conclusions in it, and I just wonder, is there going to be some opportunity to ask questions of the person that wrote it?
Yeah. You mean the Vineski report?
Can I jump in on that, Martha? At the Health Committee, the reason that we're pushing for we had to come down to a date, and I'm sorry it's an inconvenience for some. The Health Committee is meeting within a week or so of that date, and that's when we're going to be discussing the report. It's a special meeting. I'll announce that as we get into it. And Jack Vineski, who is the consultant, will be at the Health Committee meeting. I don't believe he's... This is not... The meeting that Joe just announced is not a Health Committee meeting. It's a special meeting for the presenters that Joe has lined up to perhaps give information, we hope, to distribute information on the CHA and the pluses and minuses of it. I assume there may be an opportunity to ask questions of that, but I don't think Vineski is scheduled to be at that meeting.
No, and again, the way this was structured, it's almost like a benefit cost. Where the cost side was addressed in the Vineski report through the meeting that Mr. Vineski attended. That was the cost side. We now want to look at the benefit side of that equation. You know, what is the value that we receive by having a CHA in our community that's run by the county? You know, the relative benefits of that. Some questions that people have about: will service be diminished? Will service be denied? What happens if a CHA goes bankrupt? All those things are on the qualitative side. We think we've assembled a group of panelists who can speak directly to that from various perspectives. It's really intended to inform your decision and the community about what's happening. That will be wrapped up. That will really all come together in at least at least one special meeting that Frank will have, where all those things can be discussed. Jack Vineski will be there, and all the questions you'd like to ask can be put to him then.
Okay, but the panel will talk about their experiences, not our experience, right?
They'll talk about their experiences, right. The state regulations that govern these programs, and so forth. And again, the perspectives, and it will be moderated by Betty Falco with the Health Planning Council. Perspectives will be of a county that has looked at its CHA and decided to keep it, a county that has looked at its CHA and decided to sell it, a vendor who isn't going to be competing on this, and the person who was, until recently, the head of long-term care for this county, who will have kind of a countywide perspective on it, again, moderated by Betty Falco.
So my understanding is this is sort of the qualitative analysis. We already had the quantitative analysis. Now, I believe that, I mean, I think it's reasonable for you to be able to contact Mr. Vineski, Peter, if you've got specific questions about the report. Maybe I think his number is on, contact information is on there.
It is. He is a consultant, so you may want to channel, if you have your specific questions, maybe if you channeled it through either me or Brenda Crosby. Prior to that, you may, and we can get it to him, or if you want to wait until the Health and Human Services Committee, you can do that as well.
Okay. The I did have several questions about things that confused me, and when I was town board member in the town of Ithaca, the policy was, and I thought it was general, that I was could not call a consultant up and ask any questions. I could only do that in a public setting, not a private. So is that our policy also or not?
I'm not sure that that's... I want this legislature to have an opportunity to get its questions answered. My only concern would be a consultant can bill by the hour.
Can bill by the hour,
so
right?
If you would get your questions to me, I'll get them to the consultant and make sure that they get answered, and the answers would be circulated to all members of the legislature.
But if it's about kind of the basic understanding of the program and how he's defining the terms, it was a dense report with a lot of jargon. So, or Sigrid might, or Brenda might be able to help too. Dooley?
I had a fair amount of trouble with the Vineski report also. And in trying to get a handful of questions answered, I went to Brenda and wound up with Frank Krupa answering the questions. He
looked up the answers for each one and got back to me. But there doesn't seem to be what Peter was asking about, and that is a chance for legislators to ask Mr. Vineski questions directly. I did learn that the Vineski report was requested by and designed to be read by health department personnel. Hence, it was not designed for legislators' ease of reading at all. That didn't make me happy, but it made me understand a little better why we had a lot of trouble reading it.
Well, there were seven of us at the meeting he presented, so that was opportunity was available.
Well, not for a lot of us who had conflicts, it wasn't available. So is Frank, at your special meeting, is there going to be that opportunity?
I would say there is, but I would say yes. That is specifically why we're going the extra mile to have Mr. Vineski come to that meeting. But I like Joe's suggestion about if any of you have any questions prior to that, as Peter has some, or perhaps you do, Dooley, or anyone else, can you get those questions to Joe? And maybe we can get those to Jack so he can come down prepared to answer them and we don't have to go through a litany at the meeting. And it might be good to circulate the questions to the legislature and perhaps Jack's answers to those questions, Joe.
Yes, do that.
Prior to the special meeting of the HHS.
I'll give you an example, and I'm not sure how helpful it would be to do it ahead of time. In reading the report and the appendices, it looked as though our CHA and the Visiting Nurse Service have one does some things better, the other does other things better, but it's a wash in terms of quality. But Mr. Vineski's conclusion was not that it was equal. And so that's the kind of mystery that... And getting it to him ahead of time, I don't know if that's useful or not.
Well, there may be some questions that are better put off until that meeting. Mm-hmm. I think I may even know the specific one you're asking about. Some of it's based on reimbursement. We're not here to discuss the report tonight, so I really don't want to get into it because some of us have torn it all apart and are probably more familiar with it than others. But if there are questions, if you don't mind, Martha, if there are questions that... you want to share with Joe, and Jack can perhaps address them prior to the meeting, that may be a good idea. And if there are ones that he would rather come to the special meeting and talk about, I would think that would be appropriate as well. And he can prepare a little bit to answer a question like that.
Yep. And in the interest of the public, this is the report that we're talking about. The Vineski report is posted on the health department's webpage. If anyone's interested in seeing what we're talking about,
Joe. Excuse me. One more thing. The meeting that we're having, the venue may change based on the discussion tonight, but right now it's scheduled for next Tuesday, a week from tonight, at the health department, the new health department's Rice Room. At 4:30, the general public, that's an open meeting as I understand it, the general public in addition to the legislature is welcome to come to that and sit in. Is that your understanding too?
Yes,
Joe?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Now, Joe, you had
I have a couple of other things too. Yeah, I hate to contribute to the tyranny of a short agenda, but I'll keep plowing through here. In terms of our familiar topics, the budget. I'll be coming to budget and capital at its next meeting with the tax levy goal resolution for that to be developed and presented to the full legislature on May 17th. After that happens, as you know, that is converted to specific department-by-department spending targets, which is another action taken by the legislature as we kick off the 2012 budget process. Very quickly, I did also report to Budget and Capital at its last meeting our mid-year budget adjustments to adjust for cuts in state aid. I've left a summary of that on each of your desks. The Budget Committee members have seen it. I can, in very shorthand, explain it. We've taken the savings that we believe we've already generated. That, first of all, our net impact this year, we've calibrated it to be about $755,000. That's after we've taken into account the fact that some of the cuts are partial year cuts. It won't affect us until July 1st of this year. Those kinds of things get the gap down to $755,000. We've identified things in our budget that we can already chalk up as savings, including the fact that we've been holding some vacancies. First part of the year, that's $240,000 in savings. There have been some internal changes that have tried to adjust for the adjusted state aid numbers. Some of those, I don't want to double count them in assessment and health, are also counted in our personnel actions. The Youth Services Division, though, is looking at the adjustment of agency contracts to help it absorb some of the cuts that have come to it courtesy of the state budget. We're projecting right now a surplus in our pre-K special education program and health. We're counting that as a savings. When you bundle all of those things together, we've identified $387,000 that is basically either already saved or safely assumed to be savings, but we still have a gap then of about $368,000. You've heard the second part of this equation that will close that remaining gap, which is, for the lack of a better phrase, a rolling hiring freeze. It simply means that on any given day, we need to have 9 positions in our roster vacant. That doesn't mean the same 9 positions. Positions that are vacant today will be the same positions that are vacant by the end of the year. It simply means on any given day, we'll be 9 positions vacant. Our attrition rate in this county is about 5 positions per month. So we're accruing vacancies over time. So as new vacancies occur, some of the older vacancies that are held in this bank of 9 can be released. So there's still a dynamic change of roster that we can do. But in holding those 9 positions vacant on any given day, we believe we can save about $393,000 in those personnel savings, including the fringe benefits associated with it. So with those actions, we believe that we can rebalance our budget, stay in line in spite of a net effect of about $755,000 in state aid cuts in this budget. The last thing I'd like to mention...
Joe, I'm sorry, before you leave that, the document I have has the footnotes cut off on the right.
It does, you know, and I made the same, I handed out the same thing at Budget and Capital. I will email you all. I've looked at it. There's nothing of substance missing from the right, but I will email you all a revised version of this that has everything that fits on one page. So you've lost a couple of words at the end of the footnotes at the bottom.
All right, and a question, if you don't mind. Do you foresee that any positions that might become vacant, there might be a decision to keep it vacant? In other words, not fill any of them.
It could happen. In fact, if you flip over the page, you can see some of the considerations that we'll look at. I mean, it could be that if there's a position that it looks like it is not sustainable into 2012, that's one that we're going to have to really take a hard look at. And I think the department heads are probably better positioned, even than I, to make those kinds of hard decisions. If you look at the criteria that I put on the back here, and these are works in progress, as we look at which ones to fill, it will... Some of the things that we'll look at, how long has that position been vacant? I think it was Kathy Luz Herrera that brought up in the committee meeting, we ought to consider the size of the department. One vacancy in a 2-person department is more difficult than one vacancy in a 100-person department. That ought to be taken into account. How much of that position is funded with local dollars versus outside money, and whether that position, this gets to your point, Martha, is clearly essential. So if we don't fill that position, we'll have to fill it with overtime. We don't want that to happen either. As a part of all this, I'll keep a log. I'll let you know if you'd like to know what positions are being held vacant, how long, and so forth. And we're developing that log database in our office right now.
Thank you, Jim.
Last quick item, corporate compliance. I brought it up the last several meetings. It's a work in progress. Paula is not only doing broadband, she's coordinating corporate compliance for us. It's something that we have to do. As a part of Medicaid regulations and federal funding requirements, I just want you to know it's proceeding on course. One element will be training. We're all going to have to go through a training period. It's a part of what we have to do. It'll be about 45 minutes of your time. It's important, and we must do it. And we'll fill you in on when as that develops. But we are making good progress on the development of the plan.
Actually, that was part of my report. I forgot. Sorry, Paula. And there's been, you sent the email just to me about which dates? Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
We were choosing dates where there was time prior to a legislature meeting. Right.
So we were looking at some dates prior to one of the upcoming legislature meetings. I'll take a look at that, and probably maybe I'll put it on a meeting wizard and just ask everybody to send back what their preference is. So everybody, but heads up on that one too.
Right. The last thing we'd like to do very quickly, and we will want to do follow up in the coming days. We put up on the screen something that we knew was going to be really hard to read. So on your desk also is a legal size sheet, looks like that, so that we can all read it. We have talked a little bit about this so-called budget simulator that my office has been working on for the past few months. I'm going to explain very briefly what it is. I need to begin with saying what it is not. First of all, it is not perfect. It is not a new way to build a budget. It is not scientific or objective. It's not a lot of things. But what it is, I think, is the foundation of a pretty good learning tool that might allow us to begin to better explain the relationship between the programs that we offer, some 300 of them, and the amount of money we spend. And I'm going to take just a couple of minutes to go through this with you to explain what this is all about. The first page, and the one that you're looking at on your desk, is an arbitrary division of all of our programs into about 18 functional areas. Again, I said it's not science. There's no science here. We simply looked at what we do, and we tried to categorize those into a relatively small number of functions. And again, there are 18 of them, beginning with arts, culture, recreation, and education, going down to disease prevention and so forth. So we grouped. This really comes out of those program impact. You remember the big book last year, the 300 programs that we tried to make available to help with the budget process? This is really coming out of that same database. So you can look at the local cost of those programs under that function, arts, culture, education, and so forth. We spend about $6.1 million, approximately. We've identified that almost $5.7 million of that is excluded. And in the heading here, it says by mandate. In fact, there's a couple of things in there that are like the library and TC3, where what we can do is limited by maintenance of effort requirements there. So if we were to cut, really the only amount of that $6 million eligible to cut is about $429,000. This is where it gets interactive with the user, meaning potentially the legislature, where in a shaded column, you could put in that box how much you'd like to see. You'd kind of like to run a scenario of an across-the-board cut in that function. Let's say it's 10%. So just for fun, we put in 10% there, and you can see off to the right that you just reduced the budget approximately $42,000 or $43,000. And if you look up above, you see that same number, $42,929. It's also 0.1% of our entire levy. And you can do the same kind of scenario building all the way down through each of those functions. I think the next one is disease prevention. Maybe you want to cut that by 5% or see what happens when you do. So it plays itself out by function. Now, Kevin, if you can scroll down, that's kind of the macro effect here. And it's across-the-board cuts to all those programs. Now, if you scroll down, and for those of you with eyes as bad as mine, if you turn over to the other side of that legal-sized paper, each of the function areas is broken down into the specific programs within that functional area. So you can see in there all the programs, beginning with the History Center, and going down to community beautification and so forth, those are the programs that fall under that particular function. And you can see that if you go one column more to the right, each one of those has been cut by 10% because you said that's the across the board that we'd like to see what happens if we do that. But if you'd like to also say, geez, I really think the community beautification program shouldn't be cut at all, you can maybe put a zero in there, and it will affect all the numbers, including the effect on levy. And you can do this by specific program. Kevin, if you'll scroll wherever it's shaded, whoever's using this can put in whatever assumption they want. If you'll scroll to the right, Kevin, see what happens. Yeah, go up a little bit. It also says, maybe I can't remember exactly what that program is. So if you put a Y in that column, it will bring up things from the database about that program. This particular one serves 1,000 people. It has a staff of 1.7 plus a lot of volunteer hours. There's other money involved in it, 48,000. And this is the shorthand version of the program description that was in those impact forms. Now, the same methodology is applied to 300 or so programs in our budget and each of the 18 arbitrarily defined functional areas that we have in here. The goal is really is a learning tool for all of us. Those pages that we produced last year were pretty static, kind of hard to get through, and it was hard to figure out what an effect of a cut might mean to that program or in that function. So again, this is a tool for all of us to look at. It has some rough edges that need to be buffed out. It isn't perfect. But in terms of trying to bring knowledge to the process, this is our effort to begin to better align programs with the amount of money that we spend.
Joe, this is incredible. And Kevin, I think you both, this is a joint effort. Can I ask what on the back page, DDDM, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good reminder. If you remember last year when we did this, we categorized all our programs into four mandate areas. DD means discretionary. Don't have to do it. We can decide how we want to do it. DM means it's discretionary, but if we decide to do it, we don't have to do it. But if we decide to do it, there are rules or mandates that tell us how we have to do it. MD is the reverse of that. We have to do it, but there's some discretion in how we do it. MM means basically we don't have any say. It is virtually an uncontrollable cost. We are mandated to do it, and we're mandated in terms of how we do it. These classifications were put on last year by the departments. There might be some that are subject to judgment or review, but that's what those letters mean in that program type column.
Pat, Jim, Frank.
That answers part of my question, but I'm still not understanding let me use an example. The very first one is the History Center,
right,
which says DD, discretionary.
Yeah.
What does that figure mean where it says excluded by mandate and eligible?
Right.
Does that mean none of it can be reduced?
Right. It's always the first one in the whole thing that is the exception to the rule. This one is discretionary. This county has chosen to do this. At the same time, we have entered into a long-term contractual commitment to provide a specific amount of money for a specific amount of time. So we really are obligated to do it. So, Pat, in that case, we've said we really can't cut that. We've made an obligation.
So is eligible for reduction almost another way of saying what we would be talking about otherwise as discretionary?
Yes.
I think that's fair.
That's a fair, okay. Okay. And excluded by mandate, we could actually just say mandated.
You could, although there may be things in here like debt service. I can't remember how that shows up. We would put that under the mandate category only because you can't cut it in a commitment. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Kevin, did you want to add something?
Part of the reason some of the numbers aren't going to be perfect is, and History Center is a perfect example of that, our contract says they will actually increase the amount they get next year and the following year. So going through this whole list, these numbers are not perfect, but they're close.
Jim, and then Frank, and then Peter.
Joe, just for our own information, give me the two numbers, our total budget and the amount of budget local money that we literally have to deal with.
I think the total budget is about $156 million, and the local budget is about $75 million.
That's close.
Okay. Thank you.
Frank?
Joe, on this, this looks like the Peter Stein, perhaps one of the versions that Peter was working on.
Right.
So this is really nice. Couple of questions, though. If we want to understand what the programs consist of, the verbiage, we can go back to the book that you gave us last year and resurrect that. Okay. The one on the back that starts with the History Center, that the only category that covers is arts, culture, recreation, education. The front side, the second item is disease prevention. Where do we get, are you going to,
right.
I know it's up there, you right. have it there, but can we access that? Are you going to send us something so we can access
yes.
this?
Yes.
Okay. And because these only deal with numbers, and as Kevin said, this is just a tool. When we get into talking about the value of the program, we may have a program that costs a lot, we can cut it out because, as Pat has already asked, it's not mandated. But the effect of cutting it out could be really severe.
Absolutely. Right.
We can get some of that explanation out of last year's book.
Yeah, in fact, this is all drawn from that same database. You'll get a Reader's Digest, you know, quick description off to the right. But yeah, you should go to the. If anything piques your interest, go back to the program impact book. Look up that program. You get a lot more detail about impact through that book.
When do you think is this already up so we can access?
We'll be okay to send it out. I'd say in the next few days. Department heads, we sent it out to department heads a week or two ago. And again, I want you to be cautious because in a program offered by my department, for example, use this as an example, we will show you the cost of developing the budget, how much we devote to it. But in that cost is the assumption that I spend 10% of my time, Kevin spends 60% of his time, others spend other parts of their time. Well, we're also doing other things. So if you decide you didn't want to do the budget anymore, you probably won't fire 10% of me. You'll fire all of me or none of me. So those kinds of nuances, and department heads, I'm sure, would want me to emphasize that, have to be taken into account when you look at this. It's really just an effort to help us learn about programs and align resources with what we do with that money.
Well, that's the same plea that some of us have been making with regard to we can cut something out, but the ripple effect, I mean, just because we're cutting it in column A and column B and column Q and in column F, the effect of that could be rather severe. I mean, yep. But that's good.
So in other words, we're going to get what sounds like it's going to be a big file, a big Excel spreadsheet.
Right.
With layers and sheets that go one sheet. Okay, but then so that you can scroll and you can pick the things you want to read.
Right. Play a game.
But then the full descriptions are in our books. Are these 2012 numbers?
These are 2011 numbers for the most part. There are some agency numbers that are actually 2010 numbers because they weren't updated for 11. So again, these are orders of magnitude. That's the way I would look at them.
All right.
One more question.
No, Frank.
Pardon me?
Peter, then Carol, and Mike, or Jim. Jim first. Then Peter, Carol,
Kevin, will you be available to answer once this fires out to all of our computers? Will you be available to tutor individually?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe we can set up a Thursday at 5 o'clock. Or something. Okay. I think that's it'll be helpful to help people walk through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Okay, Peter.
I have a couple of comments to make. First place, to answer Pat's concern about what mandate meant in that particular column, it seems to me that column ought to be labeled forbidden by mandate/obligation. I mean, obligation is not really a mandate, but it's just as forbidding, okay?
It's a self-mandate.
Huh?
It's a self-mandate.
Well, it's not a self-mandate. It's a contractual mandate. That's different. Mandates means what to us means what Albany requires us to do. This is something else that we have to do. Just a simple thing.
Okay.
The second comment is that when Joe described it, he said a lot of things about what it isn't. And one of the things he said it wasn't scientific. And let me disagree with that in the strongest terms. From someone who did and taught science for most of his life, this is the essence of science. And the essence of new discoveries in science is organization, is figuring out how do you organize a complicated set of phenomenon or data so that you can sit down and analyze it and come to some kind of systemization which makes you understand it better. I could give you lots of examples of that from all fields of science, that that's always the first step and the crucial step. So I don't mean to say that this is like electricity and magnetism. It's very different and it's a small arena. But this is the way that science works, is by doing that. And I think that's in a big advance that we have so many programs. It's very hard for a human being to try to figure out how you balance one against the other. And putting it together into smaller categories makes that kind of analysis much better. So I think when you present this next time, you shouldn't say it isn't science. And the third thing is, I'm pretty familiar with this, and if you can't reach Kevin, you could ask me, and I think I understand it pretty well.
Thank you, Peter. Carol?
So in over what time frame, first of all, will we have this available to use at home?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then over what time frame will we have it before I...
Well, again, we'd like to... I think there's no reason why we can't get it out to you very quickly within the next couple of days. You just, you'll need to understand it's 2011 data that we'd like to, as this goes on, probably enter the 2012 data as it comes in for the budget. But for the moment, there's not going to be a test or anything like that. We just want to give you this resource to be able to look at programs and start thinking yourself about how a cut in a certain area might affect bottom line and impact on the community.
Right. Well, I'm just anticipating that, it's one thing to go through a first cut with the information we have in here now. It's another thing as we start getting closer to the fall and into the fall and have information from our department heads and from the public, as we develop our own different pictures of how do you craft a budget, will we continue to have it available to play with? And then it's also one thing, if it's a whole lot easier to be ruthless when you're sitting at home without the flesh and blood in front of you and the department heads and the questions being raised that make these words on paper come to life. So just, it would be useful to have it as we update it with the numbers.
Absolutely.
And then is there going to be any attempt to sort of collect our information and collate it or do anything with it to help us then see, not individually have to defend our numbers in each particular program, but sort of collectively where we as a group or the average for this one or that one.
I haven't thought that far ahead about this. I think that may be up to you to decide how to use this tool. I think you are going to find it may reveal priorities as you decide what to do in certain functional areas. It may reveal priorities, and that may be helpful as part of this process. But in terms of collating and finding consensus from it, I'm not sure. That's something that we would need to talk about later.
Mike.
First of all, just a mechanical question. If we want to increase a line, are we able to do that? You talk about putting in cuts. For example, if I wanted to increase a line by 40% one place and reduce another by 20%, let's say, or 60%, can I do that? Or is it only cuts?
I think
if you put in a minus 40, I'll bet you it'll increase it.
That's right? What I'm asking. It is a way to increase a line if you wanted to. And the other thing I would say is, and I like your caution, Joe, over the years, we've been very, very hesitant to think about cross-the-board cuts because of how they can affect people and people-organized programs. And we all know that none of these programs got there without a lot of serious consideration. And so as we're looking at it, cross-the-board doesn't work. I remember distinctly in 1994, there had been a across-the-board cut. And we had to spend the next year trying to figure out how we put money back in the gasoline budgets or the heating budgets that had been cut, even though it was very clear that we would have to spend that money.
Thank you, Mike. Pat?
I just wanted to say thank you. This is an amazing piece of work, and it must have been very time-consuming, and it's a new way of looking at things, and I just want to say I appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat. I agree. This is a tool we've never had, and I look forward to really digging into it. We're going to have really more difficult decisions than we've had before, and I think this will be a big help. I would just one other point. For example, on the library, in a sense, it's not a mandate. You know, we could not fund the library. That's a choice. We lose state funding. And the point is, I think we know understand there's a maintenance of effort issue if we cut it a certain amount. But there's also the option of simply not funding it. That one kind of stands out, in that category. Anything else on this?
Yeah, may I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
Joe, on the single sheet that you gave us earlier, that's a sort of a companion to this but deals with 2011, the date on that memo is the 25th of April.
Mm-hmm.
Are those figures as best as you could get them by the 25th of April?
Yeah, I think they're as good as they're going to get until DSS gets their specific allocations from the state, which could be May, could be June.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Martha.
And there's, is Nathan there?
Nate's just shook his hand. Is that
Nathan?
No, Nathan.
Oh. Okay.
That's Obama.
Oh, I thought I recognized them.
Really? Yeah, that Nathan got. That's great. That's great. Thanks,
Looks
Kevin.
Looks a lot like the president, Kevin.
Yeah. That's great. I think
Peter's confused
Listen,
again.
I have one other question on the budget simulator. Since our target is a certain levy increase, I wonder if reduction in levy is what that top number should be. I mean, should it? It seems to me if I, in trying to work through this, I would like to be able to make, to know what I'm, all right, we're starting at 13%. With no cuts, we've got a 13% increase in the levy. And we know we've set ourselves a target of 5.4 or 2 or whatever it is. Is it possible to flip the math so that you're looking at it the other way?
I don't know that we could, Mara. I'd have to think about that. I mean, I think that the number to look at is how much has been cut. So as you're making these decisions, if you know that our need is to cut $4 million or whatever, $3 million, whatever that number is, that's where my eye would go.
Okay.
You know, how close can I get to that?
Okay. All right. Thank you both very much. That's great.
Thanks.
County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
I wanted to talk a little bit about freedom of information, and particularly in light of an email that people got from a citizen. Freedom of information actually takes a lot of our time, takes a lot of time in administration, particularly by Andrea, takes a lot of time in the county attorney's office and ITS and many other. It really goes across all divisions of the county because we get quite a few freedom of information requests from citizens, from the press, all types of, some from businesses. And it takes a lot of time to gather this information. And we rarely discuss it with the legislature or anything because rarely are there issues involved in it. It's just a time-consuming issue because it's not always easy to gather materials, and it's becoming increasingly difficult in the electronic age, unless, and you know, I think Greg has talked about improving our electronics to make it easier to do that. Under New York State law, every county has to adopt the Freedom of Information policy, which we've done. And as part of the policy, you have a Freedom of Information officer, and Freedom of Information inquiries from anybody go to the officer. And if the officer denies any Freedom of Information request, you have to have an appeal officer, and appeals go to the appeal officer. Under our policy, Joe is the Freedom of Information officer, meaning requests come to him in his office, and I am the appeal officer. So if the county administrator denies a request, which doesn't happen very often, the letter that someone would get, a citizen, would tell them that the request is denied and why, and that they have the right to appeal to the county attorney within so many days, and how they do that. And that happens periodically, and that's just part of any Freedom of Information process. Sometimes we, while it's pretty rare that something is denied, there's usually a good reason for it. And sometimes I would overrule that, and sometimes not. But it doesn't happen that often, because 95 or 99% of things requested are granted, if we can figure out what they are, et cetera. You received an email from a citizen about denial of an appraisal. And to be frank, the email was perhaps a little misleading. The individual requested an appraisal. It was denied, and Joe sent an explanation as to why it was denied. The individual appealed. I affirmed the denial, and I sent the individual a letter, but it had the list of cases which hold that this appraisals are exempt from freedom of information. He did not mention that in his letter, but there are several cases on exactly that subject, and I sent them to him. Or I sent the sites for them. There is also, as some of you may have heard, what is called a Committee on Open Government. And the Committee on Open Government is a group of people headed by Robert Freeman, but there are several attorneys in the office now, who give opinions on Freedom of Information requests. They give advice to governments as well as to citizens. They are not at all shy about saying that they disagree with a government's decision or not, but significantly their opinion is just their opinion. Unlike the cases, it doesn't have any force of law. And interestingly, sometimes they disagree with the cases, and it becomes, and it's pretty clear that you follow the law and not their opinion. In this case, the person requested an appraisal, and it was denied. It's pretty well-established law. And I sent to the person the cases which established that law. He sent to an opinion to the Committee on Open Government asking for an opinion, which every citizen has the right to do. They don't always give them. His email suggests that they gave him a positive opinion, but in fact they declined to do that. They did not give him an opinion. What they did was sent, and they often do. They often do give citizens opinions, but they chose not to do it in this case. And they sent him three past opinions which was directed to that same similar subject, or the same subject. Which unusually, because they usually disagree with the municipality, in this case they actually supported the municipality. But I did want to explain, so what we did, the denial is well established in law, and that's, but I think I did want to explain why counties and municipalities deny appraisals, or requests for appraisals, and why that is. And why the law says that that's permissible. This is on a DOT eminent domain project, and it's a DOT policy to begin with not to give them out.
And there are a lot of different reasons, but one of the main reasons, and probably the most important reason, is that under the eminent domain procedure law, there is a process for exchanging appraisals. And the process is designed to ensure fairness. And the main thing that the process wants to ensure is that when you exchange initial appraisals, you give your appraisal and the other party gives its appraisal without the benefit of seeing one another's appraisal, and therefore they're more objective and neither party has an advantage over the other. So if the county or municipality or the state were to give its appraisal to the other side before, then the citizens or the taxpayers of that municipality would be disadvantaged in the litigation because the other side would have their appraisal and they wouldn't have, and the county wouldn't have its appraisal. So it's designed to ensure fairness, and as part of the rules, after you exchange appraisals, then you can react to the other's appraisal. So, and it's in the law that, you know, how you exchange appraisals, and it's designed to ensure fairness in the litigation. Second reason is that the appraisers who prepare these appraisals, they themselves would be at disadvantage in being questioned, etc., if their appraisal is given out and the other appraiser can work from theirs, but they can't work from his, and they would find that most unfair and don't want to be put in that position. And so if a municipality like the county would just give these out upon requests, I think that the companies which do this would not be very inclined to work for the county. They would want the county to follow the rules of the eminent domain procedures law like everybody else. So that's essentially why they are denied it. It's well established in law. It puts the county at a disadvantage in the legal proceedings if we do that, and so we don't do that. By the way, the numbers you give out, it's just the process, what the actual report that you don't give out. So the people have the numbers, they just don't have the report. And what the report largely consists of is comparing, like, your parcel to other parcels and then adjusting. And in these type of cases, what they actually do, because we're almost taking, you know, almost exclusively its properties without buildings, is that establishing square foot values for property based on comparison with other comparable properties, and making adjustments based on whether you're taking it as a fee or as a permanent easement or as a temporary easement, and then making adjustment based on what's there, for example, if there's valuable trees or fencing and things. So all of that is accounted for in those appraisals, and the individuals are given the numbers of the appraisals. Oftentimes there's actually more than one, but they're given the number of the highest because we have to pay under law the number of the highest appraisal. So they're offered the number of the highest appraisal, and if they wish to challenge it, then we would exchange appraisals. They would get ours, and we would get theirs. But that's just some background on how it works. And but I will say this. I've been doing this for 18 years, and we've taken I don't know how many parcels, but like quite a few. I mean, on Tripphammer it was over 100. On Warren it was probably over 100. And where we take small parts. So maybe we've taken 1,000 parcels, and this is the first person ever to ask for it. We have exchanged in the past on one occasion when we did go to a litigation about the taking of a building on which the Department of Social Services now sits. But we exchanged the appraisals in accordance with the rules for exchanging appraisals in an eminent domain proceeding, and they didn't ask for anything different. So that's the history. I realize that you know, sometimes you get an email from somebody sort of out of context, but that's the history, and that's sort of how the decisions are made in freedom of information. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Peter.
Aye.
Yeah, since I was mentioned in the email, I'd just like to comment and clarify exactly what I did in this situation. The individual emailed both Dooley and I, Dooley and me, and asked us to facilitate his getting this information, which he felt he had a perfect right to. He lives in my district, and I firmly believe that if a citizen asks for your help and you represent him, you have an obligation to look into it and see what you can do for him. And I did this. I called him up. We had a conversation over the telephone. He explained the situation to me from his point of view, and I frankly couldn't imagine why we weren't willing to give him the information. His request sounded reasonable. I said I would look into it and I would call him back. And I called up Jonathan, and we had this conversation more than once over the telephone. And when I felt that I understood it, I called him back and told him that I would not do anything to do that to further him. And we had a conversation why he said, why are you not representing me? And I told him it was an interesting ethical problem for me, that here I do represent him and I have this obligation. On the other hand, I'm a member of the county, and I have to represent the best interests of everybody in the county, meaning the county government. And he was engaged, or I felt that it was clear to me why he wanted this information, namely to further a lawsuit against the county. And I said to him, that's why I think you want this. If you can give me a legitimate reason why you ought to have that information, other than this, I might reconsider. And he said, no, he declined to give me any information. So I said to him, well, that being the case, I don't feel I have the right or the obligation to help you in this. So that's my story.
Thank you, Peter. Anyone else? Will?
Thank you, Martha. And thank you, Peter, for that explanation, and Jonathan for walking us through. I have no doubt that we are correct within the bounds of freedom of information. And viewing it from the perspective of a potential lawsuit, as you are clearly doing, it's probably appropriate to be responding defensively. But when I got that same email that I think we all got, I was viewing it from the perspective of just a landowner, and I was trying to imagine how I would feel if local government came and said, I want to take a few feet off the front of your yard, and we're going to, we're not going to give you any choice. We're taking this whether you want it or not, whether you want to give it or not. And we will decide what to pay based on an appraisal. And I understand that there are times when it's absolutely necessary for eminent domain. It's not our preferred method, but we need to have that tool. What didn't seem reasonable was that we would not be willing to share the document that formed the basis for what we were offering. The document typically involves comparables. So you have some basis that, okay, there is a logic to that. And it just seemed that we were being asked to that the landowner is being asked to accept our number, and that it came from a reputable firm, but we will not tell them where this came from. And if you don't like it, your choice is to sue us. And the amount of money probably would not be normally worth hiring a lawyer for, I'm guessing, just because it's a relatively small amount of money involved. But it somehow did not strike me as right. And if I'm the only one here that feels that way, I will not pursue it. But that's what I said.
Joy.
Well, my reaction is similar to Will's. And I'm in the process of pursuing it, but Jonathan was away for a couple of days, so I haven't had my conversation with Jonathan. I understand what he said tonight, but I still would like to talk with him. I also talked with Jay Franklin briefly to try to understand from that perspective. And so I will I'll see you, Jonathan.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much, Jonathan. I would like to ask, what's your pleasure? Should we take a brief break, or should we keep going? Because there's not that much on the agenda. The tape people want to take a break. They rule. What, Jim?
You may already know, Inside.
Okay. It'll take Jim just a couple minutes to change the tapes. I know that helps him a great deal. Aurel, hang in there. All right, we'll be back at 10 of. Break for just a recess.